Chapter 49. First Weeks in Paris. While Germany was racked by bloody insurrection, politicians and bureaucrats from all over the world were meeting in Paris. From January 18, 1919, to June 28, when the Versailles Treaty was finally signed, there were 1,500 sessions and 24 commissions. Despite the glittering social life, the delegates still had time to indulge in schemes and intrigues. Lloyd George, flanked by Churchill and Balfour, busied himself by outwitting Clemenceau, who was busy clearing the deck of French politicians he thought useless or incompetent. Ambassador Cambon and President Poincaré were shunted aside, leaving Clemenceau on center stage. Immediately before the proceedings opened, a Czech politician lobbying to become prime minister of a yet-to-be-created Czechoslovakia was nearly assassinated. Brazil obtained 3 seats on the Supreme Council without anybody knowing why, since the Brazilian army had hardly crossed swords with the Germans. The Slovakian delegate, Milan Stefanik, was shot down over Bratislava by Czech agents whose masters were determined to suppress Slovakian sovereignty. The famed Polish musician Paderewski, who had become president of Poland, was cutting a dashing figure at the Paris Opera. Colorful delegates from exotic parts of the world had joined the conference either to press their own demands or just to be part of the ongoing festivities. The German delegates were, on the other hand, ostracized. They were excluded from the conference deliberations, they were not to be heard or seen. Only during the very last days did they appear, to sign the treaty. On that occasion, they were greeted with a hail of stones. One German delegate's secretary was hit in the face and lost her right eye. Paris was the setting for 5 months of continuous parties and revelry. Thousands of more or less authentic victors were celebrating. Fashionable writers like Proust, Cocteau, and Gide were much in demand in French salons. Revolutionaries were also highly prized. Madame de Juvenal, a leading socialite, gave a magnificent reception in honor of the assassin of Russian Grand Duke Serge and the Tsarist minister Plev. Bedroom diplomacy was also elevated to new heights with the influx of thousands of Czech, Romanian and Serbian high-class prostitutes brought in by the Central European delegates. Their mission was to reinforce the claims and demands made at the conference table in the intimacy of the boudoir. Clemenceau commented, "These girls are destroying the conscience of the arbiters of peace." The Slovak Stefanik was outraged, but his colleague Benes felt that ladies were playing an essential part in convincing the delegates that it was wise and proper to place the Bohemians and Moravians as well as 6 million Germans, Poles, and Hungarians, under Czech control. Benes' star performer was called Doria. She spoke 5 languages and developed great influence among all the delegates staying at the Hotel Crillon. The British delegate Nicholson greatly admired another outstanding practitioner, Madame Alexander. She knew everything, had access everywhere, obtained everything she asked. She was one figure who made history but was not known to the general public. If some delegates lost their conscience, others lost their health. The Puritan Wilson was quick to take to the Paris nightlife. His detractors claimed he had contracted a venereal disease that drained his already precarious health, and his predicament became the talk of the conference. Clemenceau saw fit to exploit the situation by passing the word around. His right-hand man Tardieu told House, "I understand it is a very delicate matter, but we fear the president is about to suffer a physical breakdown." Nicholson had remarked that all the delegates were stunned by his psychophysiological collapse. All those opposed to his 14 points were delighted with Wilson's predicament. They would even hold meetings at his bedside with apparent sympathy, while hardly able to hold their glee. Wilson was aware of his illness and was terrified its nature could be revealed to his puritanical electorate. At first he made an attempt to stand by his 14 points, but finally gave up. Within weeks there would be nothing left of them. Even had Wilson led a life of absolute virtue in Paris, his plan to reform the world was doomed from the start. The British government was determined to grab oil-producing countries in the Middle East despite all the treaties and agreements they had signed to the contrary. French politicians were determined to occupy Saarland, the Rhineland, and points east militarily. A greedy mafia of Serbian, Czech, Romanian and Polish politicians was equally determined to trample human rights and gobble up 20 million Germans, Slovaks, Hungarians, Croatians, and Austrians without the slightest consultation. The dismemberment of Turkey and the appropriation of German colonies by the British were also on the agenda. The indigenous peoples were parceled off as in the days of slavery. Wilson had come to Paris with the highest political and moral authority. Without him, the Allies would have lost the war in 1917. Even in June 1918, Tardieu had declared he no longer believed in victory. The Germans had contacted him when they decided to surrender. Wilson had negotiated the armistice conditions himself and secured their acceptance by the Allies. Under normal circumstances, he should have had his way at Versailles. As Bullitt wrote, "In the history of humanity, the future has rarely depended on one man to such an extent as during Wilson's first month in Paris. When he found himself facing Lloyd George and Clemenceau in House's office at the Hotel Crillon on March 14, 1919, the fate of the world depended on him alone. But not one Allied signatory of the armistice had accepted it with sincerity. Their war aims, the real ones, had been arranged among themselves with secret treaties during the course of the hostilities. They were diametrically opposed to Wilson's peace plans, including impartial justice and equal rights for all people. In the eyes of Clemenceau, the 14 points were the ramblings of a lunatic." President Wilson, page 360. Although Wilson realized the Allies were not cooperating, he could do little about it because he had absolutely no knowledge of European affairs. An observer said, "His ignorance of Europe bordered on the fantastic. It left people stunned with disbelief. He had no idea of the existence of 3 million Sudeten Germans, whom Czechoslovakia wanted to enslave. Masaryk had never talked to me about them," Wilson said. Wilson was also convinced there were more than 100 million Jews in the world. Teams of foreign affairs experts from Harvard, Yale, and other Ivy League centers had been set up to inform the president, but Wilson did not seek their advice. Robert Lansing, his Secretary of State, was knowledgeable about Europe, but Wilson did not let him put his ability to use. Even House was losing his influence, because Wilson's second wife did not like him and warned her husband almost every day that he was a Judas. The British politicians had not waited to meet with Wilson before helping themselves to everything they wanted. Their war aims had been satisfied at the time of Germany's surrender, since they had already acquired German assets and colonies. Their aim at Versailles and Paris was to sabotage the French, whom they now regarded as their new rivals. They also regarded Wilson's peace plan as totally irrelevant. Wilson's geographical ignorance was matched by that of Clemenceau, who looked upon Central Europe as a confused jungle. France was all he knew and all that interested him. Tardieu, however, had enlisted experts to prepare a lengthy list of claims and reparations. Bureaucrats of all countries were kept busy in 58 commissions. They made little impact and were only called on to produce demands to back up the various ministerial councils. The Council of Ten, which was the Council of Five with the addition of the five major presidents, held 72 sessions, the Council of Four, without the Japanese minister, held 145 sessions, and even the Council of Three met when the Italian prime minister stormed out of the meeting, shouting, "Down with Wilson!" Harold Nicholson, the English delegate, took extensive notes of the proceedings and published them in a book called Peacemakers in 1919. He recalled, "The work was discouraging. One felt so fallible in these matters. A map, a pencil, a transparent paper. My heart sank at the thought of the individuals our erratic lines would save or reject." Nicholson described the proceedings during a meeting at the Conference of Paris. "Afternoon, final revision of the Austrian borders. I walked to Rue Nitot after lunch to brief A.J. Balfour. Inside a room with heavy tapestry below the portrait of a smiling Marie de Medicis, the sound of a fountain could be heard coming from the garden. The fate of the Austro-Hungarian Empire would be decided in this room. Hungary would be cut up by five distinguished gentlemen with indolence and irresponsibility. While the water sprinkles the lilac trees, while those with knowledge anxiously observe, while Balfour dozes off, while Lansing doodles, while Pichon lounges in his large armchair, winking like an owl, Transylvania is redrawn. After Tardieu and Lansing trade insults like tennis balls, Hungary is dismembered by noon. They go on to Czechoslovakia. For Yugoslavia, the committee's report is adopted without modification. Then afternoon tea and macaroons is served. On May 13, 1919, Nicholson and his colleagues were called to enlighten Lloyd George, Balfour, and Wilson about Asia Minor. They spread a large map on the dining room table. Everybody sits around the map. It is like a cake about to be cut and served. Lloyd George explains his proposal. The Italians demand Scala Nova. No, says Lloyd George, you can't have it, it's full of Greeks. He continues to show them there are other Greeks in Makri and along the coastline. I whisper to him, no, there are very few Greeks around there. He answers, yes, there are, can't you see it's colored green? I understand then he was confusing my map with an ethnic map. He believes green means Greek and brown means Turkish, instead of valleys and mountains. Orlando and Sonnino chatter in Italian. They demand the coal mines of Eregli. Lloyd George says, but it is bad coal and in any case there isn't much of it. Sonnino translates the remark to Orlando, who answers, I want them, it's good for my morale. Finally, they appear ready to accept a mandate on the Adelia region, but we do not know very clearly if in exchange they will give up Fiume and Rhodes. We pull out the agreement of the League of Nations concerning the mandates. We notice it stipulates, with the consent and wish of the people concerned. They find this phrase very amusing and they all laugh. Orlando's white jowls wobble with mirth and his puffy eyes swell up with tears of joy. It is immoral and impractical, but I obey my orders. Professor Clive Day from Yale University confirmed Nicholson's observations. Each time a territorial question rose, they pored over the maps with imperturbable gravity. However, no one knew whether the maps were upside down. It really did not matter anyway. What happened in Paris, 1918 to 1919, page 30. As if this were not enough, many of these maps had been tampered with. Lloyd George himself became aware that the maps and accompanying data had been falsified and gave vent to his outrage publicly at Queen's Hall. All the documentation provided by some of our allies during the negotiations was false and cooked up. We have made our decisions on the basis of a fraud. It is in such ignorance, irresponsibility, and dishonesty that the Versailles Treaty, the most important treaty in the history of the world, was organized. Field Marshal Smuts, Prime Minister of South Africa, then a British dominion, admitted later, everything we have done here is far worse than the Congress of Vienna. The statesmen of 1815 at least knew what was going on. Our statesmen have no idea. To the political incompetence of the day one must add the general venality of the press. Not unlike today, it had the power to make or break all incumbent or prospective politicians. Anybody could be a hero one day and a pariah the next. The press decided what was news and what was not. The press lords had become fabulously wealthy before the war. Millions of dollars poured in from Russia, Serbia, and Romania to the proprietors of newspapers, who in turn dictated to the politicians to lend vast sums to these countries. Corporations also sought the favors of the press by plying them with cash, stocks, and even a generous share of their profits. French politicians knew who was boss and lived in fear of running afoul of the press. They yielded to the press baron's orders every time. The Russian and Serbian millions were well invested. The press blackmailed the French government to lend billions of gold francs to Russia and Serbia. The press lords, of course, were getting commissions on these loans. The billions naturally came from the pockets of the hard-pressed French taxpayers. It would have been political suicide for any politician to voice opposition to such loans. Even during the war, Russian money kept coming. 1 million gold francs went to Le Figaro. This was at a time when a soldier risking his life in the trenches was paid 5 cents a day. The making of the Versailles Treaty considerably raised the stakes for the power and money-hungry press. It was no longer a matter of getting fat commissions on extorted loans, but of a share in cutting up the world. All the Versailles victors were there to acquire territory. The Czechs wanted a corridor slicing through Hungary so they could unite with Serbia. The Serbians wanted to gobble up Albania. The Greeks wanted Smyrna. The Italians wanted all the land between Fiume and Adalia, well inside Turkey. Rich with French loans, all these voracious claimants plied the press with a continuing flow of money. The press conducted an ongoing auction. Whoever paid the most could be reasonably assured of a favorable treatment for even the most absurd claim. French academician André Morois noted, "The agitation of the masses was not only unfortunate, but it was the work of a press interwoven with governments. Le Temps had the highest rates, from 100,000 gold francs to 200,000 per documented article. Figaro and Le Matin fetched 50,000, the journal, De Debats, 25,000 francs. The favor seekers continued to outbid each other, often with dire results. Le Temps dropped Serbia after receiving 3 million gold francs and it was paid 5 million to say the opposite. Serbian politicians, well versed in corruption for many years, declared themselves to be outraged. Dragomir Stefanovic, son-in-law and spokesman for Serbian political boss Pašić, declared, "We are very displeased in Belgrade at Le Temps's attitude. It is useless to spend more money to buy its goodwill." There was also a heavy traffic in business deals and contracts. Le Temps's owners had been granted a construction contract in Russia as well as exploitation rights in Serbia's richest copper mines at Bor and in the Slovakian forests in the summer of 1914. Fortunes were made almost overnight. By February 1919, the Romanians admitted having spent more than 10 million gold francs, without counting petty bribes, added the chief delegate of Bucharest. "But at that price Transylvania and Bukovina will really cost us nothing. Indeed, at that price it would cost Romania an average of 3 francs per Hungarian in the denationalization and annexation of the Hungarian population and territory." The greed of these people at the trough of victory even shocked Clemenceau, who called them jackals. The American Secretary of State, Lansing, was appalled and made public his fears of the consequences of such practices. In ignorance and corruption, the fate of the world would be played out. The League of Nations would be created, the maps of nations would be redrawn, populations would be annexed or exchanged, huge reparation schedules would be set. There was never any question of rebuilding peace with Germany. The Germans were meant to be reduced to total impotence forever. To ignorance and corruption could be added blind hatred. Germany was to be destroyed by any means. Allied politicians saw in Bolshevism a wonderful adjunct of vengeance. Germany was to be hammered into oblivion between Allied vengeance and communist terror. The Paris atmosphere was so thick with hatred that all those who did not display genocidal tendencies toward the Germans were immediately branded enemy lackeys. The American delegate Bowman complained, "At all times one had to give tangible proof of hatred against the enemy lest one be accused of being Germanophile." Churchill, however, did not object, showing himself a consummate demagogue, "One must satisfy an excited crowd." Clemenceau was blunt, "The peace conference is a continuation of war.